Well, welcome everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank the organizers for the chance to speak. I applaud their courage in asking me to speak first, and I hope this starts off the conference well. I'm only sorry I wasn't able to attend the larger program. From everyone I've spoken to, it's been a very productive and exciting program. I'm at least glad to be here to be able to learn about some of the results. So today's session, as Gordon said, is on MRI-driven turbulence, and I think there's an ever-increasing realization of the connection between the MRI and dynamo theory, and I'll try to make that connection as much as I can today. But most of my talk will be sort of a summary on what we understand about the MRI today and what current issues are being worked on and what the future prospects are in applying the MRI to various astrophysics problems. And it's all work done with a large number of collaborators. Some of my most recent collaborators are listed here. So I'm going to begin with an introduction. I'm going to assume that there are students and postdocs who work on dynamo theory and not disks who may not know much about the MRI, so I'll give you a brief introduction about what it is. There's a very useful numerical paradigm for studying the MRI called the Shearing box, and again, I'll assume most of you don't know the issues about using the Shearing box, so I'll explain some of that, and then I'll describe the current studies. But I also want to make the point that there is much more to life in accretion disks than just the MRI, and we're beginning to understand the importance of many other instabilities that, along with the MRI, will shape the plasma dynamics, and so I want to talk about some of those other instabilities and give a summary. Now, this talk has been benefited a lot from a recent workshop that Martin Passat has organized at the Institute for Advanced Study. The talks from that workshop are now online with this URL, and I've used those talks and my participation in that meeting to help guide some of the topics I'm discussing today. So again, if you want sort of, you know, hear from the experts on each of some of these, on these issues, refer to these talks. Okay, so let me begin with what is the MRI? Well, it turns out that it's been known for almost 20 years now that weakly magnetized Keplerian rotation profiles are subject to the this MRI, local linear instability. The mechanism is very simple. It's very simple to describe in physical terms why the MRI is present. This is an image actually from a global simulation of an MRI unstable accretion disk, and you see the turbulence that's been generated by the MRI. If you just take a small little two-dimensional plane in the poloidal plane, so radius and vertical height z, and you imagine a magnetic field line, a vertical magnetic field line, sort of an unperturbed state in this background disk flow. So this is this plane here, and then here's a dashed line showing the unperturbed magnetic field line. And now you imagine perturbing that magnetic field line radially. And because of the background shear flow, a radial perturbation is also going to introduce azimuthal perturbations, because the perturbation inward is going to be embedded in a more rapidly rotating shear flow. And so this fluid element, which is perturbed inwards, is going to run ahead of the azimuthal plane where it was originally located. And the fluid element that on this part of the field line here, which was perturbed out radially, is going to be moving a little bit more slowly than the rotational velocity of this red line here. So it's going to fall behind this rotating red line here. And then there's a little spring drawn between the two here to try to represent the fact that there'll be a magnetic tension force connecting these two fluid elements. And that magnetic tension will be trying to reestablish the equilibrium between those two points, the equilibrium position of those two points. And so there'll be a stress between these two points, and because of this azimuthal shear, there's going to be a component in the azimuthal plane to this shear. So there's going to be a torque on these two fluid elements. The torque is going to try to slow down this fluid element, move it back here, and speed up this one. But unfortunately, an orbital flow, or maybe fortunately, that's exactly the wrong thing to do for stability, because if you try to slow down this fluid element, it loses angular momentum, and it falls inward. Because that's the nature of orbital motion. When you lose angular momentum, you move inwards and you move faster. This fluid element will gain angular momentum, but that'll kick it to a higher orbit where it will move more slowly. And so it'll fall much farther behind. This fluid element will fall in and move faster. So this will increase the azimuthal displacement between these two fluid elements. That'll increase the torque between them, and then that'll just run away as an instability. So the background physical mechanism is deeply embedded in the dynamics of orbital flow, and the fact that this magnetic field provides a tension force between the two fluid elements. The thing that stabilizes it, of course, is tension. If you have a strong enough magnetic field, you can pull those fluid elements back together and you can suppress the instability. But that requires a very strong field. In fact, you can always find a wave number K which satisfies the instability condition no matter how large the Alfvén speed, no matter how strong the magnetic field. The only issue is whether that as a very small wave number corresponding to a very large wavelength will actually fit inside the vertical thickness of the disk. That's the only constraint on the magnetic field strength that enters. And that turns out if you work through the algebra, sort of beta 1 is the limit for instability. Now, if you're going to understand the nonlinear regime of this instability, you're going to need numerical techniques. And many codes are being used, including Zeus was used a lot. I'm sure many of you know there's a paper by Sam Fall pointing out that Zeus gives you the wrong jump conditions for certain shock problems. It turns out that that's easily fixed just by tuning the viscosity parameters that are already in the code. If you just play with the knobs that are already in the code, you can get the right solutions for all these problems. David Clark has a web page for his Zeus 3D code where he shows the correct solution computed by Zeus for all the problems that are in this paper here. Athena is a more recent Godnov scheme, and more recently many people are beginning to use Godnov schemes for studying these problems. It has both nested and adaptive meshes, and like many of these codes, you can download it from the web, and so you can use these codes for different problems that you want to use them for. And other codes that I happen to know of that have been used quite extensively for studying the MRI include the Pencil code, Nirvana, Ramses, and Pluto. These last two codes are both Godnov-type schemes. And these are just the compressible MHD codes, and there is some work in incompressible MHD. And I think diversity of methods is very good, because only by having many different solutions which agree with each other computed by different methods do we begin to believe what the solutions mean. So the fact that there's such a recent explosion in different methods in this area is very, very good. Okay, let me just say a few words about the shearing box. It's a local approximation where instead of trying to compute the global dynamics of the entire disk, you extract a small little three-dimensional volume, and you solve the MHD equations in that little volume. And you use special boundary conditions in the radial direction to account for the background shear, and you also have to add Coriolis and tidal gravity as source terms, because you're in a non-inertial frame, you're orbiting around at the local rotation frequency at the position of this box. And so it means that your MHD equations, which you can write schematically in conservative form as the time rate of change of some vector of conserved quantities like density, momentum, and so on, plus the divergence of the fluxes in each of the coordinate directions, is equal to no longer zero, as it should be for an inertial frame with no external physics other than just MHD, but here you have a source term. Can't be written in divergence form here. So you have to incorporate these source terms. And how you do that can make a difference, actually. And so there's some care required. And people have agreed that the seemingly best way to do this is to update the momentum fluctuation equations using something like Crank-Nicholson differencing for these source terms. So that means rather than updating the momentum directly, you update the momentum fluctuations, the perturbations from the Keplerian flow. And you also difference this tidal gravity term as the gradient of a potential, which can be put in flux conservative form, and that way you conserve total energy, including the tidal potential. That's important because it's the loss of gravitational energy that drives the whole system anyway, so this makes the scheme completely conservative, including the effect of the tidal potential. And then finally, you have to do something special with the electric fields, the EMFs, at the faces of the grids to conserve the total magnetic flux. Otherwise, you can have numerical truncation error leading to growth of mean flux in the box. In addition, there's this new technique, it's actually an old technique for hydro, but it's recently been extended into MHD, which I'll call FARGO. Recently, a paper by Johnson and collaborators calls it the orbital advection scheme. It's a very nice idea for numerics, that is, because it allows you to use a much larger time step and a much more efficient numerical method for studying the MRI. The idea is to realize that the orbital velocity, the v phi, I call it y here in this local Cartesian frame, but v phi here can be written as the sum of the background Keplerian orbital flow plus the perturbations to that delta vy. But the orbital flow is stationary, doesn't change in time. It has spatial dependence, but it's a stationary flow, which means that you can approach this using operator splitting. You can use the normal MHD equations to update the perturbations, delta Vy. You can write the equations in terms of the velocity perturbations and update them using your normal MHD algorithm. And then you can account for this background shear flow, since it's stationary, just using a linear advection operator. And the beauty of linear advection operators is it's very easy to come up with a numerical scheme which has no time step constraint, no CFL condition for linear operators. And so you can update this linear advection part without any limit on how large a time step you take. It's basically just a remap. You're just taking the solution and shifting it by a fixed spatial distance, and there's no CFL condition for that step. And so now the CFL condition is only the velocity fluctuations plus the fast magnetosonic speed. Not the orbital velocity doesn't appear there anymore. That's very good if you go to very wide radial domains, because the orbital velocity becomes very supersonic once you go beyond one scale height or so. And so you can use boxes which are, say, 10 scale heights in the radial domain, and the time step will be 10 times bigger than you can afford if you had the orbital velocity in there. And the method is fully second order accurate. It actually seems to be more accurate than when you don't use Fargo. That's because the CFL number gets to be so small because of this restrictive constraint that it adds yet more numerical dissipation. These fixed Eulerian methods have a dissipation which depends on CFL number, and this helps actually reduce the truncation error. So it's actually recently being applied, and I think has a very bright future. And just to show that these things work, you can do lots of interesting, very, very sensitive test problems based on the dynamics of shearing waves. So here's an example of a shearing wave. I'm showing you the equatorial plane, the radial and azimuthal directions, and here is a vertical perturbation which shears through kx equals zero and has amplification as it does so. And there's actually a semi-analytic solution for the evolution of this wave, and you can then compute the numerical, using Fargo, you compute the evolution of this wave and compare it to the dashed line as the semi-analytic solution, and you can see convergence of the full 3D MHD algorithm to the semi-analytic solution very nicely. You can measure the L1 error. You can confirm the second order convergence of the solution to, and there's many, many such problems that are possible, all outlined in this paper by Johnson, and they're all very sensitive tests of the MHD and the hydrodynamics in the shearing box. And I would say that, you know, the very existence of these waves shows that the shearing box captures the essential dynamics of orbital flow, which is, you know, the MRI and how shearing waves are amplified and react. It's not to say that the shearing box is the end, the last word. You still need global simulations to study the structure and evolution of disks, but despite recent criticism, I think the shearing box is an extremely useful experimental apparatus from which we can extract a lot of information about the dynamics. Of course, we always have to worry about how it applies to the astrophysics problem, whether we've thrown away some dynamics that's present in global disks by using the local shearing box approximation. And that could certainly be true. But nonetheless, understanding what's going on in the shearing box, I think, is still important. Okay, so we have a numerical scheme. We have the shearing box. What happens when we look at an MRI unstable initial condition? Here is an initial condition in two dimensions with a zero net field, and you see the movie of the velocity fluctuations. You see the growth of linear modes. The saturation is 2D turbulence, which inevitably has to die away. So here we go. The first result shown in the dynamo meeting is an anti-dynamo. The dynamo dies away here because it's two dimensions and there's no net flux. The inevitably, the turbulence dies away as the field gets chopped up and reconnects, and the MRI dies away. In fact, the decay rate of this turbulence in two dimensions is sensitive to the numerical dissipation in the scheme. And so this actually makes a nice little co-test. You can compare the change in the poloidal magnetic energy with time in orbits for simulations done at different numerical resolutions, 64 squared and 256 squared, using different codes. You see the linear growth rates are all captured beautifully, exponential growth, agreeing with the linear dispersion relation. You see saturation, and then there's decay of the energy, and the rate of decay depends both on the numerical resolution and on the numerical scheme. And you see that at the same given resolution, for example, this Athena code is somewhat less diffusive than Athena, and so one can sort of calibrate your numerics with this kind of a test problem. Calibrate your numerics on a problem of an application of direct interest. Of course, you should have already done all the linear wave convergence tests and the shock tubes and everything else that you do when you develop an MHE code. But this is the actual application you're using this code to study. And so it's a test problem based on the application, which makes it even nicer, I think. In 3D, then the MRI doesn't decay away. Then it, with a mean field, the MRI will continue to bubble and boil away. You get sustained turbulence for as long as you care to integrate the box. And so here's, again, an animation of the velocity fluctuations compared to Keplerian, showing this long-sustained turbulence. And of course, the interesting astrophysical information to extract from this kind of a calculation is the variation of the volume averages with time. So for example, here's the magnetic energy, an exponential growth in the linear regime of the instability followed by order unity fluctuations once it's saturated as turbulence. And you know, the original papers pointed out that this was sort of the zeroth order definition of a dynamo, in the sense that the MRI is amplifying the magnetic field and sustaining it at a at a value for times much longer than the resistive decay time in the calculation. And so this will continue to be saturated at this level for as long as you care to integrate the box. So that's just the magnetic energy. What's interesting to astrophysicists is the Maxwell stress and the Reynolds stress. Those are the components of the stress tensor which transport angular momentum and would drive accretion and explain the astrophysical observations. And if you scale that stress by the pressure, computing the so-called alpha parameter, you get alpha values for this calculation of around 0.3, right in the range that observation demands for the dimensionless alpha parameter. It's often stated that the MRI generates very, very small alphas, and that's not true, actually. Alphas can be of order a few tenths, even with a very small net magnetic flux. It's true that the amount of alpha you get depends on the net magnetic flux, but even a very small net magnetic flux will generate alphas of order a few tenths. And you know, here, one of the very first calculations, there it is, 0.3.
The external field is removed, the magnetic field.
That's coming next. Yes, exactly. In vertically stratified disks, you then have the possibility of the Parker instability as well, buoyancy, producing rise of magnetic flux out of the disk. So this is a space-time plot. This is the vertical variation of horizontally averaged quantities. So you average over horizontal planes, and you plot versus time the vertical profile of those horizontally averaged quantities. You see. This is the magnetic energy. You see the magnetic energy being amplified in the midplane by the MRI, and then regions of strong magnetic field rise out of the disk buoyantly and then dissipate in what would be a corona, a strongly magnetized region above the disk midplane. And if you plot vertical profiles of time average quantities, that is average in time as well, so then you just have a one-dimensional function, you see things like the plasma beta parameter here is very small, a few scale heights, at 5 scale heights, it's almost 10 to the minus 2. So it's a very strongly magnetized corona sitting on top of a very weakly magnetized MRI unstable midplane of order beta of order 100 or so. And you can measure profiles of the stress and dissipation, all of which have immediate implication for astrophysics, because this dissipation is what's responsible for heating the disk and ultimately producing the emission that we see. And so these kind of calculations allow us to investigate the vertical structure of disks. So there's much interest in looking at vertically stratified disks. Is there a mean field dynamo? One of the first papers by Axel Brandenburg observed oscillations in the mean BY field in stratified disks. The calculation, like I just showed you, but with slightly different boundary conditions at the top and the bottom, showed the growth and oscillation of a net azimuthal magnetic field. And as Axel, I think we'll talk about this more in his talk, but the issue, I guess, comes down to what are the effect of the boundary conditions? Because I tried to draw on the shearing box here. This is radius, vertical height, and azimuth here. And the mean BY, the evolution of the BY, has to be given just by the line integral of the electric field around the edges of the computational domain. The vertical EZ electric field on the radial boundaries has to cancel exactly because of the assumed periodicity in the radial dimension. So this electric field exactly cancels that electric field. So that if there's a growth of a mean phi component to the magnetic field, or a mean Y component, it can only be driven by asymmetries in this radial electric field. And the issue is, well, what is the appropriate electric field to impose at the boundaries? And different fields give different results. And of course, ultimately we want to do global calculations with a realistic boundary condition as far away as we can make it. And I think there's much to be learned about whether there's mean field dynamos and disks from such calculations. Axel, I think, will tell us much more in this conference. So what are the current issues being studied? Let me just go through some of them. Convergence with zero net flux, as Carrie just asked. The effect of a finite Prandtl number, the effect of finite dissipation coefficients, effect of bigger boxes, And I won't say anything about measurement of this turbulent Prandtl number. There's much interest in understanding what the turbulent Prandtl number would be in astrophysical disks, because it tells you how much radial or how much vertical magnetic field can be advected inwards in accretion disks. And there are some two efforts underway right now, which I think within a few months will be able to tell us what the turbulent Prandtl number will be in MRI turbulence. But I think it's too early to say much about that right now. I'm just mentioning it as something of active investigation. So it is true that recently Sebastian Fromang and John Papaloisi pointed out that with zero net flux, the saturation amplitude of the MRI decreases with increasing resolution. You do a 3D simulation with a resolution of 32 grid points per scale height, and you do it in a box, one scale height by four scale heights in azimuth by one scale height in vertical height, and you get the evolution of magnetic stress versus time over 100 orbits of this dotted line, and then you do it with 64 grid points, same exact initial conditions, same parameters, and you get the dashed line, and then you do it with 128, and you get this line and 256. It seems to be converging to zero stress. I guess although Sebastian has done 512 and it's come back up again, it's really hard to know what's going on. But I mean, the trend here is very clear, and every expectation is that we'll continue to go down to zero as you increase the numerical resolution. Point out that when you use no Fargo versus Fargo, it does make differences, especially early on. I mean, you really have to evolve these for hundreds of orbits to get reliable time averages because of the chaotic nature of the MHD turbulence that's generated. And that makes this extremely expensive when you're doing grids that are 256 by 1024 by 256, and you have to integrate for, this run has been integrated for a million time steps. And so to do 200 orbits, it's just very, very expensive. And so it's right at the limit of what one can do to investigate this. Unfortunately, this has cut this off at the bottom. I mean, do we have an understanding of this? We sort of have a qualitative understanding that probably it's because the magnetic field has been chopped up to ever finer scales, making it dissipate more rapidly. I think there's connection to dynamo theory here as to why this is happening with no net flux. I think there's a larger issue that one should never forget, namely, is zero net flux the most relevant problem for the astrophysical disks? Is it really possible that every single one scale height size box in an accretion disk has exactly zero net magnetic flux for all time enforced upon it? You might imagine that there will be net flux, zero net flux averaged over the whole disk, but there will be patches of larger than one scale height. Well, there will be some net flux. While I think this is an important issue to understand the basic physics of, don't worry that the MRI is going away and, oh gosh, we're back to scratch again because the MRI doesn't work. It's perhaps an issue related to the very strong constraint you're imposing that there is no net flux for all time in this calculation. A good topic for discussion, probably. Effective finite dissipation. It's been found that if you add explicit viscosity and explicit resistivity, then turbulence dies away at low Reynolds number and low Prandtl number. There seems to be a critical Reynolds number required for sustained turbulence at a given Prandtl number, again, with no net flux in the box. Again, this is a strong connection to dynamo theory, I think, where it's agreed upon now. Perhaps someone can tell me if it's true or not, but agreed upon now that there is a critical Reynolds number for dynamo action at a given Prandtl number. And this seems to be true here. So in this plot of Prandtl number versus Reynolds number, you see yeses are where there's sustained turbulence and no where there's not. As you go to lower Prandtl number, you seem to have a higher Reynolds number to sustain the turbulence. I should issue a slight caution. The general trend, I think, is robust, but the individual points may change. If you run this in a larger box, four scale heights in the radial direction instead of one, some of these no's becomes yeses. You do get sustained turbulence. And moreover, recent calculations with Sebastian's Ramses code and with Athena seems to show that the amplitude at any given point can change by as much as 50%. For reasons we're not really well understood, because Sebastian in his original paper showed very nicely using four different codes you get the same amplitude for these calculations. Suddenly we use two new codes and we get slightly different answers, and again, this is all work in progress that result may or may not persist as we do more work. I should finally mention that one of the results of the MRI workshop at the Institute was the realization we shouldn't introduce new dimensionless numbers. There's a number called the Elsasser number. This Reynolds number, this magnetic Reynolds number, is defined using the sound speed as the characteristic velocity. If you use the Alfvén speed as the characteristic velocity, you have the Elsasser number. And this Elsasser number differs from this Reynolds number by basically a factor of beta. Beta in the saturated state is of order 100 or so, which makes this number, Elsasser number, about 100 times smaller than this Reynolds number. Turns out a Elsasser number of 1 is what's needed for instability. If you're below that, you won't get any MRI. If you divide these numbers by 100, you're getting uncomfortably close to the linear stability requirement for the MRI. Some of this dependence might be a reflection of the linear properties of the instability, that these numbers are actually pretty low. These are very, very diffusive flows that people are investigating. And maybe that has something to do with some of this behavior. Increasing the box size has been enabled by this Fargo method. You can do boxes that are 32 scale heights wide now. And so this is a thin box I showed you before. And I've used the same resolution here. I haven't involved it as long, but embedded in here are 32 boxes wide and 32 squared boxes of this size embedded inside this thing here. And so you can investigate how this affects the turbulence. Is there a turnover at large scales imposed by the finite thickness, one scale height thickness of the disk? You might hope to see that radial power spectrum taken in the radial direction should show a turnover at a characteristic scale equal to one scale height, which would mean the MRI is local and that global stresses between very distant regions don't dominate the stress. And so some preliminary results. Well, first of all, using no net flux, that's the same sinusoidal varying magnetic field, same parameters as Fromang and Papaloisi used. Here's the 32 grid points per scale height, 64 grid points per scale height runs I showed you before. The smoothly varying run is the larger box size. So it still seems to be converging to zero in these bigger boxes. It has the same mean amplitude as in the smaller boxes. It just shows much less fluctuations, which is perfectly understandable because in bigger boxes, you have more parasitic instabilities. These parasitic instabilities are very important for breaking up what's called the channel solution. It's an axisymmetric mode, which tends to dominate the MRI. The parasitic instabilities break up these axisymmetric modes into turbulence, and these parasitic modes grow faster, and there's more of them when you have a bigger box, and so you have less fluctuating turbulence. You also have just a simple issue of much better statistics when you have a bigger box, so whatever's going on gets averaged out. Any fluctuations that's going on gets averaged out. With a net flux, you recover the same amplitudes you got before with a smaller boxes. So the dashed line is a domain which is one scale height in the radial dimension. The solid line is 8 scale heights in the radial dimension. And the time average stress is exactly the same as both. And moreover, degrees completely with so-called saturation predictor that Holly, Gammy, and Balbus put forth in 95. There has been other work in this problem. They agree that the mean stress is the same. They interpret this slightly differently. The fact that there's no fluctuations, they interpret this to be a serious limitation of the shearing box because you've and when you use a small domain, you get these parasitic modes more preferential, and you get these fluctuations. I don't philosophically don't necessarily agree with that. I think that since the volume averages are the same, that's the most important thing. There's no quantitative change in the turbulence. And the fact that the parasitic modes go away in bigger boxes is completely understandable. It's exactly what you would have expected. And so this is just reflecting the physics that you would have expected. So just to turn the page a bit, make things more complicated, let me point out that there's a lot more to life than the MRI in disks. There's this Parker instability I mentioned, which is important for buoyant rise of flux. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about two other instabilities that are present in weakly collisional plasmas, the magnetoviscous instability and the magnetothermal instability. Now, I won't even have a chance to talk about the photon bubble instability, which might play a role in the atmospheres of radiation-dominated disks, and RT and KH, which can play a role in disk-star interaction. All of these can result in magnetic field evolution and amplification. And so if we want to understand dynamos and disks, then all of these things may come to play at some point or another. Let me talk about the MTI and MVI. It occurs in a new regime where the mean free path of particles in the plasma is long compared to the Larmor radius. And when that's true, the plasma is in this weakly collisional regime, and all of the microscopic transport coefficients become anisotropic. So electrons are spiraling on the magnetic field lines. They move a large distance before they collide. And so thermal heat conduction, which is generally mediated by electrons, is mostly along the magnetic field lines, is anisotropic. Similarly, viscosity, which is mediated by the ions, well, the ions are tied to the magnetic field lines. They move a long distance before colliding, so viscosity becomes anisotropic. So we've implemented the full Brzezinski anisotropic dissipation or diffusion coefficients into Athena, and we've looked at the effect of this. And it produces qualitative changes. Anisotropic heat conduction, you get a new convection criteria. It no longer depends on the entropy gradient, it depends on the temperature gradient. This becomes known as the magnetothermal instability. And in these shear flows, it turns out there's also a new instability called the magnetoviscous instability. And moreover, the presence of this viscous instability and the MRI in the same flow can lead to qualitative changes in the growth and saturation of the MRI. Now, these weakly collisional plasmas have much application to accretion onto black holes in AGN and in compact objects where the plasma is very diffuse. And so these are very important regimes for certain classes of astrophysical accretion flows. Let me explain this magnetothermal instability, and then I'll turn to the magnetoviscous instability. So what's amazing about this is it completely turns the convective stability criterion around. It no longer depends on entropy. That's the normal criterion for hydrodynamical atmosphere. But with ideal MHC and anisotropic heat conduction, it only depends on the temperature gradient. So let me explain how this works. If you have a stratified atmosphere with gravity pointing down, so this is, and suppose you create an atmosphere where the entropy was high here and low here, so it would be stable against convection by the hydrodynamic criteria. You have a weak magnetic field, which is initially horizontal, and so it's parallel to the isotherm. So in the equilibrium state, there's no heat transport in the equilibrium state. And so this is a perfectly nice, hydrodynamically stable atmosphere. And you imagine perturbing the magnetic field lines and ask what would happen. It turns out that this would, in fact, be convectively unstable, even though the entropy is increasing upwards. Why? Because a perturbation of the field lines would look like so. This would mean that this fluid element, which rises up, adiabatically expands a little bit. It cools off, whereas the fluid element pushed down is compressed a little bit and heats up. So there's a temperature gradient along the magnetic field line, and because there's conduction along the field line, then heat will conduct from this fluid element to that fluid element. It'll raise the entropy of this fluid element, make it rise up, decrease the entropy of this fluid element, make it fall down. This makes the magnetic field line get even more bent to the background temperature gradient. This increases the heat flux even more, and away it goes. It only works when you have anisotropic heat conduction. So does this mean that everything you've learned about stellar structure evolution is wrong? Of course not, because in stars, heat is not transported by anisotropic conduction along field lines. It's transported by photons. And photons don't care about the magnetic field, and so the conduction is isotropic. This changes nothing in dense plasmas. It only changes things in diffuse plasmas where you have strong anisotropic conduction. And so there was a linear analysis predicting this instability. There's been a number of nonlinear simulations that shows that you get MHD convective turbulence, as you would just this is just like sort of normal convection, except it's being driven by temperature gradients rather than entropy gradients. So here's a three-dimensional domain with a stably stratified region on the top and bottom and an unstably stratified and I'm showing you a movie of the magnetic energy, and you can see this vigorous, sustained convection driven by the magnetothermal instability, even though the background initial state was hydrodynamically stable. So there has lots of applications to clusters of galaxies, hot plasma and clusters of galaxies, but it also has application to convection or to accretion flows. I mean, this is supposed to be talking about the MRI and accretion flows, so I should be talking about accretion flows. Well, it turns out yes. So it could be stabilized if you have a strong magnetic field, just like the MRI. If you have a very strong magnetic field, then magnetic tension will stabilize this because you'll pull down the you'll straighten the field line just from Lorentz forces, the stress associated with the magnetic field lines. There is a critical beta, but it's like the MRI, of order unity or so. It doesn't need 10 to the 10 or something to get it going. What's interesting is it doesn't go away no matter how large beta is. So if beta is exceptionally small, this instability will still be present. It doesn't require Lorentz forces to get it going. Lorentz forces actually just turn it off. So it doesn't work in low beta plasmas, but it will sort of work for arbitrarily high beta plasmas. So that, you know, one of the most simple solutions for accretion we have is a spherically symmetric Bondi solution. And it turns out the spherically symmetric Bondi solution is unstable to the MTI. If you look at the inflow time, this dashed line in the Bondi solution, and you compare that to the growth time of the MTI, given sort of Spitzer conductivities, given a flow around a massive black hole, you can see that the growth time of the MTI is much less than the inflow time over an extremely wide range of radii. This is the radii scaled to the Bondi radius. So you would expect the MTI to be present in the spherically symmetric Bondi flow if there's a weak magnetic field present and you're in this weakly collisional regime. And so recently, Pratik Sharma at Berkeley has done nonlinear simulations of the growth of the MTI in the Bondi flow. Here's the flow with no conduction, and you see that it remains spherically symmetric and agrees with the analytic solution you've got before. And here it is with thermal conduction, and you can see the fluctuations introduced by the turbulence generated by the MTI, the convective motions due to the MTI. It leads to a very large amplification of the magnetic field, but surprisingly, very little change in the time average density and temperature profile. So it doesn't change the mass accretion rates by substantial amounts, but it does change the magnetic field strength, which as you move ever inwards can have an influence because you're amplifying the magnetic field at large radii. That amplified field is being sucked in and compressed. Eventually, the field is going to have an effect at very, very small radii. So even if you start with a vanishingly small field here, the MTI is able to amplify the field before it gets to the black hole and could have effects at very small radii. You know, after all, in the galactic center, you go down to 10 to the minus 5, the radius of the Bondi, the Schwarzschild radius is 10 to the minus 5, the Bondi radius. So you have many orders of magnitude in radius here to operate and have an effect. So here's something which is not even MRI unstable. It's an accretion flow, and it has interesting dynamics driven by another instability, the MTI. If you put in rotation, you would get the MRI as well, and then you worry about, sorting all that out. But you also might want to put in rotation and you get this magnetoviscous instability. So now we're getting three things going on at once. Once again, in a weakly collisional plasma, you get viscous transport along the magnetic field lines only. And the mechanism of this magnetoviscous instability that results is exactly the same as the MRI, except rather than the magnetic tension transporting angular momentum, it's the viscosity. So I show you the same pictures as I did before, and I'll explain it exactly the same way. Here's a background disk. Here's a poloidal plane. Imagine a magnetic field line initially at this vertical straight line, this dashed line. You imagine perturbing it radially, and because of the background shear flow, it means that one fluid element moves ahead and one fluid element falls behind. And I drew a spring here to represent the tension. Well, now imagine that's not tension of the magnetic field line, it's viscosity. Viscous transport, there's shear between these two fluid elements in the azimuthal direction. There'll be viscous transport of angular momentum between these two fluid elements. That'll make this fluid element lose angular momentum and fall in. This one will gain angular momentum and move out. That'll increase the shear along the field line, increase the viscous transport rate, and it's just going to run away. And it, again, works for arbitrarily small magnetic fields. The magnetic field is just a conduit to provide transport of viscosity, the viscous stress. And strong fields will shut it off. So once again, if you have a small beta, this magnetic tension will suppress the MVI. And so very recently, we started looking at the nonlinear regime of this instability. Here's the orbital time. Here's the Reynolds stress now, because the Maxwell stress is virtually zero. Here's the Reynolds stress for a large number of simulations done with different coefficients for the Brzezinski viscosity, giving effective Reynolds numbers from 10 up to 10 to the 4. This is pure MVI because we've chosen a beta of 10 to the 10, which means the field is way too weak to see the MRI on this grid. It's not resolved on this grid. So there's no MRI here. This is simply the growth and saturation of the MVI. You get substantial Reynolds stress, you get turbulence, you get magnetic field amplification, all driven by the MVI, all done in the shearing boxes, just like an MRI calculation. And you can see that, interestingly, the saturation amplitude depends on the coefficient of the Brzezinski viscosity. We haven't figured that out yet. It's independent of the magnetic field geometry. You get the same answer no matter what the initial magnetic field geometry. This little straight line here is the analytic growth rate. And we're at least confident we're getting something right because we reproduce the linear dispersion relation with these simulations. And just to demonstrate, you get magnetic field growth. Here's time and magnetic energy with 10 to the 12 initial beta up to 10 to the 4, these values of beta are so weak there's no MRI at the resolutions we're simulating, but nonetheless you get enormous growth of the magnetic field in a very short amount of time. In fact, the linear growth rate amplifies the magnetic field by a factor of 10 to the 5 every orbit. And so that's a huge growth rate. You can imagine in protogalaxies where the MRI, where the magnetic field is too weak for the MRI, that this viscous instability could play a role in amplifying the seed magnetic field given to you by the whatever battery processes work in the large-scale structure formation. So it could be quite important. As you increase beta, inevitably the MRI kicks in. And suddenly there are MRI modes that become unstable, and you can see a qualitative change in the slopes. This run is MRI is barely resolved. Only the slow going, the fastest growing mode here is not resolved at this value of beta. And these values here, the fastest growing modes, are resolved. And so you can see the interaction of the MRI and MVI in these calculations, giving you sort of additional amplification from what the MVI could have given you by itself. So we have a whole new sort of experimental paradigm now to understand for protogalaxies. Namely, it appears the MVI could play a significant role in the dynamics there. And you know, just to emphasize this once again, if you imagine putting a shopping list together of the things you want to do in astrophysics to understand black holes and neutron stars, accretion disks, disks around white dwarfs, or disks around young stellar objects, I divided them up because the parameter regime in each of these cases is quite different, and so the physics you need to add is quite different. And if you imagine, what physics do you need to put in to understand disks around black holes and neutron stars? Well, you need radiation MHD because the radiation pressure is very important. And I've added a few names here from efforts that I know are already underway in trying to understand the interaction of radiation with MRI. Anisotropic viscosity and conductivity, I've just talked about. Self-gravity can be important in the outer regions of AGN disks. In white dwarfs, you need radiative cooling and a temperature-dependent resistivity, which is being proposed as a way of explaining outbursts in dwarf nova. And modeling the boundary layer, when you have an MRI and stable disk interacting with the stellar surface, it produces a boundary layer inevitably, but no one has really investigated how an MHD boundary layer is going to behave. And in YSO disks, we need to put in Hall MHD, ohmic dissipation, ambipolar diffusion. There's been quite a lot of work in the sort of linear modes in those regimes. We need to understand the interaction of the disk with the stellar magnetosphere and with forming planets. I put this up to point out that if your problems are motivated by the astrophysics, there's a tremendous amount of physics that we need to put in yet, and we are only in the very early days of understanding all of what's going on. For example, the radiation MHD problem. I think this is correct, that there's five simulations to date that have been reported in the for stratified radiation-dominated disks. We're sort of in the realm of the early days of gamma ray astronomy, where there were five photons. We have five simulations, and you know, that's really not enough to understand the physics of the MRI and radiation MHD. These simulations are very challenging, they're heroic. It's amazing we have any at all. The point is that we've got a lot more to do in all of these regimes. So I think astrophysicists are sort of humbled by how much more there is to do, and we are nowhere near saying we understand the MRI and we're done. We have to understand it in so many different contexts. And, sorry? I'm being recorded, so I'm not going to answer that question. And then, you know, just if we're not humbled by all of this, we should be humbled by the fact that, of course, at the end of the day, we really need to be doing global simulations to calculate the structure and evolution of the disks. And, you know, sort of ironically, the only global simulations that have been investigated in detail are for full general relativity MHD. You might think is the most difficult problem to start with. You're doing the full GR and MHD together. But that's what's been investigated in great detail with global simulations. Global simulations of thin disks have been reported, but they've been investigated to much less extent. And so there's still a lot of work just to study the basic MRI without all that other physics in globally geometrically thin models, global models of geometrically thin disks. So let me summarize by saying that we've learned a lot about the MRI using the shearing box, and what I think is encouraging is that we're beginning to be informed by dynamo theory, especially the no net flux case, about what we observe regarding the saturation of the MRI. So for example, microscopic diffusivities affect the saturation, and I think there's connection to the dynamo community on that point. Modeling astrophysical disk, however, is going to require a lot more than just the MRI, and there's much work that remains to be done to understand the interplay of the MRI with all these other physical effects in astrophysical disks. And then finally, we're all awaiting a systematic study of geometrically thin disks, including stratification and radiation, which will be immediately applicable to observations, interpretation of observations of disks. And I think that's in the next few years is going to be a very active area. And I'll conclude there.
Thank you very much. Well, we're a little bit ahead of time, so we have plenty of time for discussion. And please, if you want to ask a question, wait for the microphone to reach you.
Would you comment on what type of environment is a disk embedded in? What has it inherited in terms of external fields? And that bears a great deal on how much flux is around.
Right. And again, that depends very much on which astrophysical object you're talking about. If you're talking about black holes and neutron stars, well, in some contexts, they're accreting from a binary companion. So the accretion stream is very well defined. It's continuously being fed. And the magnetic field it's getting is probably some random field that's present in the stellar envelope that's being invected inwards. If you're talking about AGN, however, of course, it's accreting from the ISM. And the accretion is probably very intermittent. Large clouds can be accreted. You have a burst of accretion. The magnetic field is probably the galactic magnetic field that's tied to those clouds. So the question really depends on which kind of problem you're looking at. And it's an important point that to really understand the evolution of disks, you have to understand the context in which they're embedded. I personally think that global simulations of binaries have the best chance of sort of being the most well-defined problem, because you know exactly how the accretion disk is being fed. And in some cases, the dynamic range and radius is not that big. It's actually quite reachable with current computer resources. So you could well imagine a completely well-posed problem for a global simulation of a binary disk, say, around a white dwarf.
Yes, I have two questions, one technical and one physical. Mm-hmm. The technical, at the beginning you mentioned that the code conserves total energy, and
yes.
I was wondering whether it was also conserving magnetic helicity and cross-helicity.
None of the Eulerian grid codes that I'm aware of have been constructed to conserve helicity. They've been constructed to conserve net flux. So at the level of a grid cell, the net flux is conserved, but net helicity may not be conserved.
And my second question was more physical. In the nonlinear state, the saturation you observe, do you see any tendency for the saturated state to be such that V is parallel to B?
So for V to be parallel to B, the answer I think is no, that there are always fluctuations which
On average, if you make average of B,
well,
and average of
V. It's certainly true that the dominant component of the magnetic field is azimuthal, the Y component. It dominates by a factor of a few up to a factor of 10. And of course, the background velocity is the shear flow. So the most important component of the velocity, the dominant component of velocity is indeed parallel to the dominant component of the magnetic field, yes.
Other questions? Axel?
Have you verified that the buoyant rise, as you said, of the magnetic field away from the midplane is indeed due to magnetic buoyancy? I mean, can you check that there's density fluctuations and vertical velocity fluctuations that incorporate that?
So recently, in the context of one particular kind of calculation, namely these radiation-dominated disks that were done by Shiganobu Hiroshi, Omer Blaze, and Julian Krolik, they did look in detail at the structure of the magnetic field, the velocity field, and the density field in the upper layers of the corona, and argued convincingly that the Parker modes were dominating up there. But it's only for that particular calculation that I know the analysis has been done so completely.
For this rise,
yes.
Which is much, much longer. It's, in your case, I think it's 8 orbits. In my case, it was between 30 and 50 orbits. Maybe quite different from the from the rise in of small structures in the corona.
That's true. In fact, investigating, I mean, surely the buoyant rise time depends on the stratification of the disk, which is given by the thermodynamics. And that actually hasn't been investigated very thoroughly, namely how the buoyant rise time and how much energy is dissipated in the corona depends on what you assume for the thermodynamics and therefore the stratification of the disk. So the calculations I showed with Miller all assumed an isothermal equation of state, which is sort of the simplest thing, making it marginally stable, and you know it could change substantially with more realistic cooling. I think you did cooling. I think there's much more to be done with the models involving cooling.
This is maybe a technical question, but in your simulations where you use Brzezinski is usually because the gyro radius is much, much smaller than the scale size you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And you're also looking at extremely high beta plasmas in which the magnetic field is quite weak. So are those compatible with each other in disks? So as you go down in magnetic field strength, the gyro radii get much bigger, and I would be surprised if the plasma is still magnetized.
You could certainly get to a regime, you probably do get to this regime in accretion flows around black holes, which are very diffuse, for example, the galactic center, where the particle mean free path is much larger than the radius of the disk. And the gyro radius can be substantial compared to, any relevant scale, let's say the Schwarzschild radius near the black hole. And there it is questionable to be using the MHD approximation with just anisotropic diffusion coefficients. You should be doing a full PIC simulation for that. And, yet again, another whole window. No one has done a PIC simulation of the MRI and collisionless plasmas. It remains to be done. I'm sure there's going to be interesting and amazing things come from that, too.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dan.
So I know that the history of the field and much of what you've showed focuses on linear instabilities, and even starting with Velikov, looking at linear instabilities. But having spent years in the lab looking at fluid and MHD instabilities, many we see are linear instabilities, but many we see are finite amplitude onset or with hysteresis. Mm-hmm. And was wondering if you could comment on whether these different states that have been explored numerically, do they often show hysteresis? Are there states in these codes that are only reachable with a finite amplitude, velocity, or magnetic perturbation?
This is a good question, and I'm actually not sure the answer. I don't know of anybody reporting hysteresis effects. Maybe somebody else in the audience does know something, but I don't know of any.
I guess one has to seek it directly. That is, you can't necessarily get it accidentally.
Right, and I think people have been focused on trying to understand the linear stability and its application to astrophysics. They haven't really been motivated by that question, so I'm not sure that anybody's really systematically explored.
Yeah, I guess in an astrophysical context, you could imagine all sorts of perturbations from the nearby environment that could cause these.
Right. And this is one of the great things about the experiments that you and others are doing, is that I think we're going to inevitably be forced to look at those issues, because you may see them in the experiment. And to understand the experiment, you're going to have to look at those sort of things. So I think that's going to open up a new motivation and a new sort of way of looking at the MRI and just these magnetized rotating flows in general. But as for the kind of calculations I described today, the answer is no, I'm not aware of anybody who's looked into this.
Yeah, we made numerical simulation of dynamo in Taylor-Green flow. So that is a flow force by the Taylor-Green vortex. And you see a finite amplitude dynamo and hysteresis.
I have a question about this magnetoviscous among the thermal instabilities. Apparently, they require that you have a large magnetic field large scale enough to launch it, right?
Yes.
So what is the critical scale for the field that you have in the beginning? Will be related to the gyro radius or the mean free path?
You would need a field longer than the gyro radius. Mm-hmm. Like the MRI, there's a very broad range of wave numbers which are unstable. So mm-hmm. all you would need is a field larger than the unstable mode you're looking at. But for the MVI, the fastest modes have the highest wave numbers. So I guess those are the smallest wavelengths. So as long as you have a field which is correlated on small lengths, you'll see these fastest growing MVI modes.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that, for example, in clusters of galaxies you don't have large-scale magnetic fields isn't an obstacle.
I don't think so. In fact, I think, again, the situation is exactly analogous to the MRI. Somebody could have asked me that question in 1994 or 1995, and once again, you don't need a large-scale field over the entire domain. You just need a field correlated on scales the size of the unstable mode. In fact, people looked into with the MRI, people looked into putting in tangled magnetic fields in the initial conditions for which the linear analysis would not be applicable, and nonetheless saw the growth of the MRI and saturation and turbulence, just like the uniform field case. I would bet that the MVI would show exactly the same behavior if you put an initially tangled magnetic field. You would see MVI modes growing, and it would probably saturate. That's just a guess, but that would be my guess.
Jim, could you speak about what is likely to be forthcoming in global simulations that aren't necessarily GR? The work has been there because you've been going after the prize of how to get good beaming engines,
yes,
and things,
sure,
like this.
That's right.
But it's much easier not to be GR. Could you tell us a little bit about what is feasible probably in the next 5 years?
I think it's easier and harder with GR. It's easier with GR because the inner boundary condition is really nice. It's flow through, all the caustics go in, you never have to worry about, all the characteristics go in, you never have to worry about information coming out. That makes the self-consistent boundary condition in the middle of the grid easy to impose. What's actually difficult about global simulations without GR is those boundary conditions. What are you going to do at the middle? Because you're going to have accretion, you're going to have mass piling up, and you're going to have magnetic field piling up at the inner boundary. Do you try to advect it through the grid? But then what do you do with the magnetic field components? You want stress-free boundary conditions there? Do you want to impose fixed field components, net flux? I mean, there's many choices one has to make, and the solution you get can depend on what choices you make. That's what makes global simulations without GR somewhat difficult. What do I think we're going to be able to do? Well, I mean, I think that you should be able to do, a factor of 100 in radius with, at least 32, but probably 64 grid points per scale height, and evolve that for, long enough to see what happens. See what happens in the sense of, does the magnetic field rise out of the disk? Do you get a corona? Do you get a wind? What is the mean alpha? What's the mean accretion rate? There's many, many things. And it's not to say that nothing's been done yet. I mean, there have been calculations done with H over R of around 0.1, both in cylindrical geometry, even back as in the early 90s, Phil Armitage did calculations in global cylindrical geometry. And more recently, Richard Nelson and Papaloizou and others have been doing global simulations of H over R around 0.1. Integrated for a few hundred orbits. They've looked at the effect of planets interacting with this turbulence. So I think there, some of the pioneering work's already been done, but I think that there needs to be a systematic study that's yet to be done of disks that are very thin, say H over R 0.05 or even smaller. The razor thin disks like you get in some compact objects where H over R might be 10^-2, 10^-3, that's going to be very difficult to resolve the interior. But it's just computers. And with Fargo, you can remove the orbital time, the CFL condition on the orbital flow speed, so that'll help a lot.
Your talk about the MVI was extremely interesting. The relative importance of MVI to MTI is obviously proportional to the magnetic Prandtl number, and therefore it's important in proto-galaxies and clusters of galaxies where the Prandtl number is really as big as perhaps 10 to the 30th.
Yes, right.
The next question is, do you see possibilities, and I'm looking here at Carey, to do it actually in the lab? Because he is planning lab experiments in various settings. So, I mean, all you need is vertical stratification, a weak magnetic field, and anisotropic conductivity.
You need radial shear for the MVI, you mean, or what? Okay. Well, let me turn it over to Carey.
Yeah, you don't need shear. You just need stratification.
For the MVI.
It's driven
by the background orbital shear motion. The MVI doesn't require vertical stratification.
And then MTI?
MTI does require thermal stratification.
Right.
But it could be thermally stratified in either radius or in vertical height.
Exactly. That's the one that Carey could do in the lab, perhaps.
Yeah, I think in the, so I'll talk about this on Thursday, but we have a plasma Couette flow that that has a whole bunch of these plasma effects built into it, one of which I've been looking at more carefully then this one is the role of neutrals and the Hall of conductivity, which looks like it could be very important. But the moment you have anisotropy is introduced by magnetic fields on the microscopic transport coefficients, everything gets much more interesting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we hope to look at all these things.
In your simulations of horizontally large boxes, have you looked at the spectra, and do you see any evidence of the generation of a large-scale magnetic field?
The answer is no. We haven't looked at the spectra. You know, how can I say that? But I'm afraid that we have not had time to look at the spectra, and it's high on our list to do. We've been looking only at volume-averaged variables today.
Any further questions?
So you mentioned that effective alpha goes to zero in simulations with net zero flux in increasing resolution. So do you think that this is the effect of effective dissipation going to zero, or effect of something else? So do those codes retain finite dissipation that would be physical?
The codes actually have a dissipation which is a strong nonlinear function of the solution. In fact, if you just set up the shearing box with no perturbations, the code has zero dissipation because the flow will be grid-aligned and the numerical viscosity will be absolutely zero and the numerical resistivity will be absolutely zero. As soon as you have, you know, flows that cross the grids and so on at weird angles, you begin to get dissipation. And the dissipation is a function of the flow speed and the magnetic field strength. So it's very difficult to interpret the behavior on a simple sort of Navier-Stokes and ohmic resistivity, because in fact there is none. In some circumstances, the flow will be absolutely, Reynolds number infinity, magnetic Reynolds number infinity. But in other cases, if you're driving the turbines very strongly, there is dissipation on scales which vary according to the solution. So, how is this helping answer your question? I'm not sure. I think the answer that I've heard discussed most is that the convergence to zero stress is a function of the resolved scales in the problem, that the magnetic field has been chopped up into ever smaller scales, and the stress associated with those scales is less and less and less. And so the field is being dissipated more efficiently at smaller amplitude. I'm not sure if that answers the question directly, but.
So following what you just said, does that mean that there's a numerical MVI and MTI in your simulation?
A numerical MVI?
Because the dissipation is anisotropic.
I doubt very much it would be represented by Brzezinski viscosity, so I don't think there would be an MVI.
Okay, well, let's thank Jim again. The next speaker is Martin Pesce.